But right now, here's Bill talking with Leo Panitch.
Thanks, Tom. Leo Panitch, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill.
Leo Panitch is a Canadian, writes and teaches about the U.S. and global system. He's a really big thinker, a sober thinker, but sees visionary possibilities. Leo Panitch, Barack Obama has been reading history about Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Obama and the administration apparently see themselves as having to save the Union and the capitalist system, too. Is this just political posturing, political positioning? How do you see the current crisis and the Obama administration's efforts so far?
Well, I think they are cast in the role that Roosevelt was to some extent in the 1930s, that is, of saving capitalism. And although Roosevelt, by 1936, was being called a socialist and even worse, a communist by many people in business, many people on Wall Street, he explicitly was oriented to saving capitalism and made no bones about that. And Obama is in much the same situation in what is the most severe economic crisis since the 1930s. The difference may be that it now looks like Roosevelt was rather more prepared to step on capitalist toes than Obama is. He was prepared, for reasons we could talk about, or was pushed at any rate in the 1930s, to do things that he thought were necessary to save capitalism that the capitalists with a much narrower perspective didn't like. Obama doesn't seem to be capable of asserting, either on his own or because of the people he surrounded himself with, asserting that degree of independence from the capitalist class in the United States.
You're referring then to the crisis in finance and the banking system and the absolute need to restructure it, yet he seems to be relying on a lot of the same old guys who have kept their positions and their bonuses.
Yes, and he seems very frightened that to do anything that might undermine their confidence further. So even though the banking system is completely dysfunctional, even though we can see that it serves a completely social purpose and that the whole economy is dependent on it, but nevertheless is held in private hands, in the hands really of very few people, he doesn't seem ready or capable of going beyond that to turn the financial system into a public utility. The result of that is that both the American economy and really the world economy is frozen by virtue of the fact that private bank lending is frozen and is just not profitable for bankers, and they see it as too dangerous for them to be engaging in lending. And the stimulus program, no matter how rich, won't have the kind of effect that people hope it will have unless it is multiplied by lending through the banking system.
What is the alternative to Obama's reliance on and really pleading with the bankers to begin lending again, which they aren't doing for actually good banking reasons?
That's
right. You really don't know the health value
of the assets they're holding.
Right, and the capacity and whether these companies or people or whoever you're lending to will survive the downturn.
That's right. And they're even afraid, let alone subprime mortgages and all of the derivatives built on them, they're increasingly afraid that the corporate bonds that they hold will be defaulted on, or the third world private or public bonds that they're holding will be defaulted on, as trade collapses, as profits in the third world collapse, and so on. In that context, he is a prisoner of the reluctance of the banking system, having, led us into this mess, to now get us out of it. And the alternative would be to indeed nationalize the whole banking system. Now, most people on the left in the United States then say, nationalize it, eat up the bad debt, and then sell it back after the public sector has eaten up the bad debt, has socialized the debt, as one can say, give it back to the private bankers. That's what was done in Japan in the late 90s and Sweden in the early 90s. But in fact, that is a extremely undemocratic way to go. And what I would say this provides us with an opportunity with is to finally take this crucial element of our society into the democratic domain, into the public domain, and change the criteria upon which banking and really the decisions about what's to be invested, where it's to be invested, how it's to be invested, to finally take those decisions into the democratic public arena.
It's going to be a long time, though, before it seems to me the administration, they're going to have to be driven into it, and the American people are going to take your advice. It's not inconceivable, though, that they will be driven into it if the crisis keeps deepening and if the population gets more desperate and worried. It's important to talk about that right now, the necessity of it, and also the great potentials of it. How do we do that?
Well, it's not going to happen without tremendous pressure from below for it to happen. And that can come from a very, very wide variety of sources, from the workers who are not only being laid off but are being forced to reopen their contracts with the auto companies, even while the managers in the banks and the insurance companies hold on to their million-dollar bonuses on the grounds that they have contracts. But it doesn't only apply to working people who see the hypocrisy and the essential class nature of that. It also applies to small businessmen. It applies to professionals. It applies to people very broadly in the middle class who increasingly in this crisis can come to see how dependent they are on the decisions of a small group of private bankers. But it would need a tremendous amount of pressure from below. And what Roosevelt did that was really reformist during the New Deal, and it did make a difference to people's lives, was done under that kind of pressure. It was done under the mobilizations of the unemployed, the enormous mass mobilizations of people in the labor sector, which led to the great unionization reforms of the 1930s and so on. There was also a radicalization in the universities and in the media, which pushed all of this. Some of those people found their way with these radical ideas into the Roosevelt administration. But it was pressure from the outside as much as from the in, really more from the in, that pushed him in this direction. Now, Obama has called for people to put pressure on him. And one would hope that those people who were so active through the Internet and in door-to-door campaigns would be putting pressure on him now after the election. We'll have to see the extent to which that happens.
Yeah, I wonder if that call for pressure, even if very sincere, and I suspect it may well be, it doesn't in fact take some of the pressure off, because those people who would have to be applying the pressure are hearing from him that somehow he's on their side. I'm working for you. Please, we'd almost be better off putting pressure on George W. Bush, at least in the United States now.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point.
Yeah, and then we 3.4 million people last week were on the streets in France protesting and challenging the government and frightening them to death.
Yeah.
It's not happening in the United States.
I think that's a very good point. But that also has to do, of course, with the decrepit nature of the American labor movement and the lack of organizational coherence of the American left. The French are capable of pulling off these one-day general strikes, and this one was bigger than usual given the context of the crisis. Nevertheless, they're capable of pulling these off because the left is far better organized, both in the labor movement and more generally in politics, than the North American left is in general. And what this is going to require is a transformation of the nature of trade unionism in the United States, some of which there are signs of it taking place in certain sectors, not least in California and out on the West Coast generally. but also via new political organizations. And there again, you could say, the hope that's been invested in a resurgence of the Democratic Party as a spokesman for working people and so on may delay that. On the other hand, it's to be hoped, and this was the case in the 60s, that as with the Kennedy-Johnson years, that this will give a fillip to movements and to political organization and political radicalism rather than be a damper on it. And that's what did happen in the 60s.
Leo Panitch, this is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Leo Panitch. He's done many wonderful books, lots of essays, one called The Globalization Decade, a book. A second, Renewing Socialism, Democracy, Strategy, and the Imagination. We've been talking about the economic crisis, the Obama's efforts, the Obama administration's efforts that so far have been probably not commensurate with the degree of the problem, and also talking about the possibilities of big movements in the United States. Leo Panitch, your assessment of sort of the U.S. left and the labor movement, seeing them both as quite anemic and disorganized and unable to actually lead the kinds of struggles that would be necessary. That implies, though, that there's still something there, clearly, and it implies that it's going to take a while, and it may well be that we're going to have some time because this crisis is likely to get worse, although one can never tell. Soothsaying is not our strong suit, but it does look very serious, and they're not going to be able to reconstitute in the old way. Am I right about that? It seems the financial bubble that kept the economy going for various bubbles for 25 years are not going to be reconstituted. Do you see that sort of long-term, it's going to be a long-term struggle that in fact, progressives can work in?
Yes, I think it is. I think that we have time, if you want to put it that way.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and a lot of people are going to suffer as a result. Yes, I see this as a very, very serious crisis and one that is going to last and that there's no easy way out of. And it is necessary, as you're implying, that people have patience in that context. And that they do come up with short-term reforms, immediate reforms, as well as generate a long-term vision and be open about the inadequacy of the short-term reforms. So, for instance, Bernie Sanders just last week called for a cap on interest rates on credit cards. And what we indeed are seeing is that the extent to which the American economy depended on working people, middle-class people, living on credit in a context where their incomes had been constrained for so long since the 1970s. They were able to keep up their standard of living through credit. And they now are in a situation where although the interest that banks are paying if you put $5 into an account is practically zero, they're charging people 20, 30, 40, 50% on their credit cards as people can't afford to pay off the minimum debt. And Sanders has introduced a piece of legislation in the Congress that would put a 15% cap on these usurious payments. And that's good. That's a good thing. But it also speaks to the enormous inequity of that reform, that what is considered to be a good thing is that people should be paying 15% interest to the very banks that themselves are giving practically no interest to money put into the banking system. So they're making a profit, if you like, of 15 times what they're paying out. That should show the necessity of the reform and the inadequacy of it. And people ought to struggle for that reform and then struggle for far, far more radical alternatives of the kind I was speaking of in terms of banking being a public utility. Those things are possible to combine in a political mobilization. And hopefully that is going to happen. And you can see that across the board in those areas where you're seeing a collapsing industrial sector. Let's take the auto sector. It is necessary to secure the kind of supports to keep plants in operation that are essential to their communities. But at the same time, it's necessary to be calling for, in the auto sector, for instance, the taking of that whole auto sector into the public arena. If you like, the nationalization of the auto companies and the parts companies, and their conversion into the production of things that people are really going to need, which is not private cars run on oil, on gasoline, on a fossil economy, if you like, but rather modes of transportation that are energy efficient, whether it's hydrogen or electricity. But more than that, the conversion of that industry into the production of things like solar panels to produce cheap solar energy, which is going to have to come in the next generation and can come with enough investment in technological change. Yeah.
Even, in fact, if government now is not ready, in fact, to basically nationalize, although they have in some ways, and just sacked the president of GM today, but if they're not willing to nationalize and, in fact, are probably going to be trying to move GM towards clean cars and somewhat new energy system rather than, in fact, really converting into a very different kind of energy system and doing wind turbines and many other sort of necessary infrastructure elements, if they're not ready to do that now, they may well be in 2 or 3 years as if we, in fact, keep maintaining the pressure and build that vision. I gather that's the way you see it.
It's perhaps a bit more optimistic than I am about where they'll be 2-3 years from now.
Or 5 years or 8 years. And it seems to me all of American life now, the health system, the justice system, the energy system, there's nothing that isn't in contest now in certainly the financial system, as you discussed.
Yeah.
Everything now is being questioned and in contest. It's really an enormous, to quote Rahm Emanuel, I know you agree with that, a really deep crisis, a terrible thing to waste. We can put it seems to me, a left vision on the agenda now for the first time in a long time.
I entirely agree with that. And I would say something else about American political culture. There is a tendency on the part of the intellectual American left, at least, and the labor leadership, to think that what the United States has missed has been the Canadian or European type of labor or social democratic party. And it's my feeling, and I felt it for a long time, that that's mistaken, that those types of social democratic and labor parties are extremely hidebound, afraid of their own shadow, very much themselves caught within the limits of the system. And there may be something quite liberating to the fact that the United States doesn't have that heavy tradition. And it may very well be possible that the American left could blow past European social democracy to something that is more democratic, that builds in a positive way on the populist and progressive tradition in the United States. And it would be a mistake, I think, although I think this is going to be most common, partly because at least of the public health care debate, which social democracy gave us and not
Leo, I'm afraid we're going to have to, I'm getting the signal that we have to end.
Well, as we said, we've got lots of time.
We have time, and people are actually enthused. There is a vision. Thanks a lot for talking to us
today.
Good
to talk to you, Bill.
Right. So long.